This is Dateline Washington on the Radio America Network. I'm Greg Corumbus. Thanks for being with us. We now continue my conversation with Tony Blankley, author most recently of American Grit. And we pick up the conversation as I ask Mr. Blankley to defend his rather unpopular call for the return of the military draft.
Yeah, I do. I'm in favor of the volunteer army. I've got a son. He just became a new second lieutenant in the army. I've met a lot of his buddies, men and some women, and they're the greatest young kids in the world. And I just wish we had a lot more of them volunteering than we can possibly get. But we've lost most of the 4,500 troops in Iraq because we didn't have enough troops here in the first place. We had the 80,000, which is all we needed to beat the Republican Guard. And then we couldn't back them up with occupation troops. We should have had 300,000 or so troops. And some of the generals said we were going to need it, but we didn't have the troops to do it. And as a result, we couldn't occupy every village and every intersection, guard every building, and we allowed the insurrection to arise, which we could have suppressed at the beginning by overwhelming force, and that's when we started losing our fine young men and women. And when Bush asked to have 20,000 extra troops for the surge, which turned out probably to be the decisive change from a losing to a winning effort in Iraq, his generals told him we didn't have the troops. He went against their advice, and they had to scramble and extend deployments, put more pressure on the troops. General McCaffrey, a lot of generals have said the army's near the breaking point for all the pressure. We're asking too much of the soldiers and their families, and we are, and I know the families, and it's very tough. Divorce rates are going up. It's unacceptable that in a country of 300 million people, we can't field an army big enough to deal with what is historically a relatively small regional war with a population barely a third of what it is now. We had 16 million men under arms during World War II. Now, we don't need that many now, but what I'm arguing for is a draft where the Army and the military gets first pick of the 18-year-old class, and then they won't need all of them, even with the increased needs that we have. We don't need everyone, and the rest of them would then serve 2 years in voluntary in national service in a civilian capacity, but living in barracks and doing some payback to the country, and then they can get on with their lives, go to college, and continue.
Another area that folks might be surprised that you're in favor of, although they might understand better once they understand why you have the position, is despite your many years in the media, you believe that during times of crisis, particularly a time of war, which we're in right now, there should be limits to what the media can print, especially
yeah,
you're talking
and
about
I,
the eavesdropping system and so forth that you believe
I'm
has compromised our security.
I'm very limited in that. I practice the First Amendment every day of my life. I'm doing it right now, and I want an absolute right to freedom of speech and dissent and policy. However, I don't believe there should be any right to publish war secrets during wartime, which has been done repeatedly by the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times. Just two Sundays ago, the New York Times reported, until then not known, that our government was covertly trying to sabotage Iran's nuclear program. Now, there can be little more valuable than stopping Iran from getting a functioning nuclear weapon. And now that effort, which was ongoing, has been revealed, and the Iranians are on their guard. So as far as reporting classified military secrets during wartime, I think that should be a crime. It was during World War II. It was during World War I. And it is a misunderstanding of the right of freedom of expression to say that secret war plans can be published in newspapers without any criminal consequence. And that's what I call for. That's the only area. Other than that, I'm a complete believer in the right of anybody to say anywhere, anytime, write whatever they want about their opinions about anything.
Tony, you also have some very specific ideas in this book about energy exploration, especially in terms of increasing our domestic supply. What recommendations do you have for the Obama administration, and what do you expect from them?
Yeah, this is an area where the administration, Obama, has been unambiguous. He's been very clear. He does not believe in developing oil and natural gas and nuclear and coal. He believes in restricting that. His new energy secretary, Dr. Chu, a Nobel Prize winner, a great scientist, nonetheless says, it was quoted in the Washington Post months ago before he was in the picture, as saying that the price of electricity in America is anomalously low. I disagree. I think most Americans believe, correctly, that abundant, cheap energy has been the foundation of prosperity. And when the price of energy goes up, prosperity goes down, as we found out briefly when the oil, when gasoline went to $4.50 a gallon. We've got a reprieve from that only because of the world recession. As soon as the economy recovers, the pressure for increased demand on oil and natural gas will keep going up. We, in fact, have it within our power to be energy independent within 10 to 20 years through shale oil. We have 1.8 trillion barrels of shale oil in the Rocky Mountains, mostly in Colorado in the Green River Formation. I've talked with people at Shell Oil who are doing exploratory work out there and other experts. There's no question it's there. It's exploitable. The only problem is that the price of getting it out plus the environmental cost of protecting the land once we finished with the extraction process is somewhere between $30 and $80 a barrel, while the price of oil drilled conventionally out of the ground around the world is, as we've seen over the last several months, anywhere from $140 to $40 a barrel. So the oil companies will not on their own make the huge investments necessary to extract the shale oil. And so what I've argued is we should do the same thing for shale oil as we did for raising grain in America, which made us the breadbasket of the world, by the way, which was to guarantee a reasonable return for the producers.
Last 60 seconds here, Tony, and I want to finish on a point that you spend quite a bit of time addressing in the book, and that's putting America's interests first. You talk about how Obama went to Berlin and called himself a citizen of the world. Exactly what do you mean by putting America's interests first, and how would that be manifest?
Well, I found that a disturbing phrase. Now, I've been around the world. I travel regularly. I have friends in many countries around the world, but I don't consider myself a citizen of anything except the United States. That's my highest loyalty, and it's my only loyalty to a country, loyal to my family and friends, of course. But I worry that Obama, when he said that, meant something by it, that he doesn't understand American exceptionalism, the fact that this country has been the blessing of mankind, that if America weren't present in the world, the hope of people for individual freedom, I think, would sink to despair. There are other good countries, but no country strong enough to protect and give hope to the people around the world, as we've done for two centuries and we continue to do. So I just feel that our obligation as Americans is to strengthen our country, not to look for fighting, certainly not, and I'm not a neocon, and I talk about that in my chapter on foreign policy, only fight when we have to for our own interests, but to be that beacon, that nation capable of defending the weak and ourselves. If we can continue to do that into this next century, we'll be a better country and there'll be a better world for it.
And there's plenty more in this excellent book that you can pick up. Again, it's called American Grit, What It Will Take to Survive and Win in the 21st Century. Tony, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Tony Blankley, Executive Vice President of Edelman Global Communications, former panelist on the McLaughlin Group, as well as a press secretary for former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, and an advisor to President Ronald Reagan. This is Dateline Washington.